All right, so we had just started a discussion of proteins. I went through the list, a hugely various list of functions that proteins perform. And the reason that they have so many different functions is because proteins really have no limit with respect to the number of shapes you can make with them. Proteins, each individual protein has a specific function. So it's not that a single protein has all those functions in the table that we looked at. Each individual protein does a certain function. But whatever the function is, a given protein has that function because of its shape. And you can, if you were creating proteins in a lab, designing them, in other words, you could make just about any shape you want. That's why they have so many different kinds of functions. And slide 16 just shows you one example of this. This is an enzyme doing its job. That was the first of the ones listed in the table, the first function. Enzymes are catalysts, and we'll talk much more about them in the next unit, but this is just an example of showing how shape is important. Enzymes operate to speed up reactions by binding to a reactant, which allows it to more easily become a product, thereby speeding up the reaction. In this case, the enzyme is sucrase. It's named after the sugar that it helps to get turned into, break apart into individual monosaccharides. Sucrose is the sugar. The enzyme is sucrase, but sucrase has just the right shape to fit that substrate, as it's called, the reactant that binds to the enzyme, sucrose in this case. And when that happens, it allows for the reaction to proceed. In this case, it's a reaction that splits a bigger thing into smaller things. So what kind of reaction is that? Exactly, hydrolysis. And in this case, what's being hydrolyzed is a disaccharide, sucrose, breaking it apart into its two constituent monosaccharides, glucose and fructose. And then the enzyme is left unchanged, so it can go around and around as many times as long as you have more sucrose. But that's just an example of why enzymes operate based on their why proteins in general operate based on their shape. Not all proteins are enzymes. All right, well, now let's go to 17 and look at the chemical makeup, the molecular makeup of proteins. What we see here in 17 is not a protein. Just like we started the discussion of polysaccharides by looking at smaller carbohydrates, which were the monosaccharides, here we're looking at not a macromolecule, not a protein, but one of the subunits from which proteins are made. This is a single amino acid. And actually, it's not actually a particular amino acid. This is just the general scheme for how any given amino acid is built out of atoms. All right, so there is no limit to the number of amino acids, which are the monomers that make up proteins. There's no limit to the number of amino acids that can be built. And that's because of this R that you see here. For a molecule to be an amino acid, everything has to be in place just this way. In other words, there is a central carbon atom, the magenta C here, and attached to that is this yellow thing, which you should already recognize even without looking at the label here, that this is a carboxyl group, right? So an amino acid has to have a carboxyl connected to its carbon, it has to have a hydrogen connected to that same carbon, and it also has to have an amino group connected to that central carbon. If those three things are just in place like that, then it doesn't matter at all what this fourth position on the carbon, making the fourth bond to carbon, is. That's why it's just denoted as R, which could be anything. The simplest possibility would be another hydrogen, but it could be any atom or group of atoms. And that's why there is no limit to the number of possible amino acids. All right? Even though there is no limit to the number of amino acids that we could build artificially, all organisms use the same set of 20 amino acids. And so, if books tell you that there are 20 amino acids, that's actually a lie. What they should be saying is that there are 20 biological amino acids, because those are the ones that cells use. And by the way, the fact that it's all cells that use these same 20 is one of several strong bits of evidence pointing to the fact that all cells, all organisms, descended from the original successful organisms, that first lineage of cells. Otherwise, you would have different groups using totally different amino acids, and you don't. Okay, so there are 20 biological amino acids, even though there are no limit to the number of possible amino acids, and a single amino acid is just a monomer, a one-part subunit that can be linked with other amino acids to build bigger molecules, and those bigger molecules are called polypeptides. And up to now, I've been using the word polypeptide and protein interchangeably. I'm going to tell you why that's not always true today, but we'll get to that in a minute. This, though, is how an amino acid looks, with R being anything you want. And if you think back to the carboxyl group discussion when we were looking at functional groups, remember I said that things that have a carboxyl group in them are called carboxylic acids, right? Or organic acids. And things that have an amino group in them are amines. Well, an amino acid overall gets its name because it is an amino and it's a carboxylic acid, so amino acid. In 18, we now see the 20 biological amino acids. These are the ones that all organisms use to build their proteins. And even though there's only 20 building blocks, there's no limit to the, you know, never mind that there are many more possible amino acids. If you just stick to these 20, there's still no limit to the number of ways you can string these together. Think of it as being a set of 20 different kinds of beads. You have an unlimited number of each type of bead. There's no limit to the number of ways you can make necklaces out of those beads, or strings of beads in different orders. That's why there's, even in biology, no limit to the number of proteins. But these 20 biological amino acids are grouped, and that's what's shown by the blue shading here. First of all, before we get into the groups, notice that every one of these shares the framework I just showed you in the previous slide. Every one of them is an amino acid because they have a central carbon connected to a carboxyl, a hydrogen, an amino, and then something else. So the only reason there are any different kinds of amino acids is that R group can be anything. All amino acids are identical except for the R group, and the R group alone makes for different kinds of amino acids. The R group in all of these, in this slide, are highlighted in white. It's the only part that makes it different. And you see here the very first one is the simplest possible amino acid when you just fill that fourth slot, the R slot, with a hydrogen. Okay, but now to the groups. One group is the nonpolar group. And what makes these nonpolar is that the R group, the variable part, is itself nonpolar. The easiest way to have nonpolar R groups in biology is to make up that R group with carbons and hydrogens only. And that's what most of these are. These are mostly hydrocarbon R groups, only carbons and hydrogens. And the reason that's nonpolar is because carbon and hydrogen have almost equal electronegativities, as we've talked about. That makes hydrocarbons nonpolar. Well, our groups for the next group are not nonpolar. They are polar. And so typically, you have an OH or something with a high electronegativity like oxygen, if it's not oxygen, bonded to a hydrogen, which has a low electronegativity. So that makes it a polar group. And the reason this is important is because, as we'll see eventually, the overall shape of a protein, once you string together those beads to make the protein, the polypeptide, it's going to fold up. That string of beads is not going to stay as a line. It's going to fold up into a three-dimensional shape. And the particular shape that it folds up into is going to depend on what the R groups are and how they interact with each other. So that's why we have these groups. This is the polar group. And then beyond polar is this bottom one, electrically charged, meaning that the R groups are ions. They're ionized. So that's what I mean by beyond polar is that polar is only partially charged, right? An ion is actually fully charged, so it's beyond polar. And actually, you can subdivide the electrically charged group into two subgroups, depending on whether it's a negative charge, which makes them acidic, or a positive charge, which makes them basic. All right. We still haven't gotten to a polypeptide yet. Those are all just subunits. But now in slide 19, we can see how a polypeptide can be built. And this really shouldn't be any news to you because we've already talked about the fact that for all the biological macromolecules, you build bigger pieces by hooking together smaller pieces using what kind of reaction?
Dehydration.
Can also be called condensation, but dehydration is the better word, in my opinion. Well, we can see a dehydration reaction here, which is why water is coming out. This is no different but than from the general scheme we looked at in the first slide, except this is using a particular kind of subunits, amino acids, in other words. Every amino acid, as I just told you, has a carboxyl and on one side, and an amino on the other side. And if you hook two amino acids together, there's only one way to do it, unlike monosaccharides. Monosaccharides, remember, first of all, they have to be in the ringed form to hook them together to make glycosidic linkages. But a monosaccharide has several different positions that you can make a link with other monosaccharides, which is why they can branch. They can have a branch point like glycogen that we looked at. There is no branching with polypeptides. A polypeptide is simply an end-to-end arrangement of some number of amino acids. And it doesn't branch because there's only one way to put these things together. Kind of like the plastic things that you can hook together. Do you know what I'm talking about? I don't know what they're called. But there's no branching to those either. You can just make a long string of them. To make a bigger molecule by hooking together amino acids, you have to make the dehydration reaction between the carboxyl end of one amino acid and the amino end of the other amino acid. All right, so any given single amino acid has a carboxyl end and an amino end. Like this is the next one that's being added. These two have already been joined, but this one is on its own at the moment. And it has a carboxyl end and amino end. Any string of amino acids, no matter how big they are, also has a carboxyl end and an amino end. So this is the carboxyl end of this two amino acid chunk. This is the amino end of this next single amino acid. And the carboxyl group is the source of the OH that's required for a dehydration reaction. The amino group is the source for the H, that's the other requirement. And the H and the OH come out as water. That's the essence of a dehydration reaction. That allows for the carbon and the nitrogen to be bonded together, making a bigger piece. In this case, now it's 3 amino acids long. Okay, now, the same thing happened with joining 2 monosaccharides, except that the subunits were, of course, different types. What did we call the specific kind of bond that forms in a dehydration reaction when you join specifically 2 monosaccharides together? What was that called?
Disaccharide?
Well, the overall product will be a disaccharide. I'm talking about the name for the bond. No, that's the bond between a fatty acid and the glycerol in a fat. When 2 monosaccharides are hooked together, the bond is called a glycosidic linkage, or just a glycosidic bond. Well, here we're doing the same process, dehydration, but when the 2 monomers, or 2 pieces hooked together, are amino acids, then the name of the bond is a peptide bond, which you see labeled here somewhere, right here. Okay? So polypeptides are named for the fact that you make them by forming a bunch of peptide bonds, each of which is formed by a dehydration reaction between 2 amino acids hooked together. Okay? That's a little bit different from polysaccharide. Polysaccharide, the name refers to the fact that you have many monosaccharide monomers. So in other words, the name refers to the subunits, not to the bonds between them. For a polypeptide, there still are many subunits, but the word polypeptide refers to the bonds between them, not to the subunits. Okay, now, a very important thing that's also shown on this slide on the bottom is that since it's only the carboxyl of one piece and the amino of the other piece that's involved in the peptide bond, that means the polypeptide, however long it is, in this case it's only 3, but usually it's hundreds or maybe thousands long in a protein. Anyway, the polypeptide is held together, the thing holding the polypeptide together does not involve at all the R groups. The R groups are hanging off to the side of the polypeptide. They don't hold the polypeptide together. But the R groups, based on which group they're in, whether they're polar or nonpolar or charged, in other words, is going to determine how the overall polypeptide, once it's built, will fold up into 3-dimensional shape and therefore affect its function. Okay. 20 it shows you 2 different ways you can represent a polypeptide. A polypeptide, let me give you a more accurate definition of this. Before, I've been using it interchangeably with protein, but a polypeptide is one strand of amino acids, however many amino acids long, it doesn't matter. Well, it has to be multiple amino acids to be a polypeptide, but what makes it a single polypeptide is that it is one strand of amino acids, so it has 2 ends and no branching, as I said. All right. Now, you can depict a polypeptide with a space-filling model, which computers can make, like on the right, and they're, I guess, nice to look at, but they don't really give you too much information. It kind of gives you the shape, though. A ribbon model is another possibility, though, on the left here. And the reason that a ribbon model is a nice depiction of a polypeptide is that it reminds you of the fact that a polypeptide is a single end-to-end arrangement of amino acids. So it has 2 ends, just like a ribbon has 2 ends without any branching. Don't worry about the yellow lines. We'll talk about those later. Those are chemical bonds formed between parts of the same polypeptide. But this is one continuous strand of amino acids, string of amino acids, one polypeptide. Okay, 21 is another example. Now, this actually involves two polypeptides. One in your body or a human's body. This is an antibody. And the reason antibodies work to recognize potential invaders in your body is because of their shape, like all proteins work as based on their shape. You can't have just one master antibody that will protect you against everything. You have to have specific antibodies that have the shape to recognize just a specific type of invading organism or virus. A virus is not an organism, but it's an invader. This is a flu virus. And notice the antibody matches up well and recognizes that shape. So you have one protein produced in one organism recognizing a different protein produced outside of that organism to protect the organism from invasion. Okay, now we need to talk about the four levels of protein structure. And these four levels, as you see, are called primary, secondary, tertiary, quaternary. Those are just words that mean first, second, third, and fourth, respectively. Now, primary structure refers simply to the particular sequence of amino acids making up one polypeptide. So polypeptides are different from each other in two major ways. They can be different in the number of amino acids that they have strung together, just like fatty acids can differ in their lengths. But they also, of course, differ in their sequences. If you are using 20 different kinds of beads, which bead you choose for each position determines the primary sequence. Okay, so it's how many amino acids there are and in which order. You don't have to know these abbreviations, but these three-letter abbreviations are just abbreviations for the biological amino acids, glycine, proline, threonine, and so on. That's all the primary structure is, the particular amino acid sequence for a single polypeptide. That's important, though, because all of the higher-level structures that we're looking at, secondary, tertiary, and quaternary, are a consequence of that primary structure. So the particular sequence is going to determine how all these other levels happen. Okay. Next is secondary structure. And secondary structure refers to whether a polypeptide features some often encountered and repeating motifs or themes, which are called beta-pleated sheets. This is one type of recurring shape within the polypeptide. Pleated sheets are like accordion pleats. You know, they fold or open up. The other kind is called an alpha helix. A helix is a corkscrew shape. And you see these in a lot of different proteins, maybe just once or maybe multiple times within the same polypeptide, or maybe not at all. That's what secondary structure is. Does it have beta-pleated sheets? Does it have alpha helices? And if so, how many and where are they? So the secondary structure is really not the entire three-dimensional structure of the whole polypeptide. But tertiary structure is. Tertiary structure represented by this one violet glob, but notice it has a ribbon inside it to remind you that it's one polypeptide. The tertiary structure is the overall three-dimensional shape of a single polypeptide once it's folded up. Okay, now every protein has at least these first three levels of structure: primary, secondary, and tertiary. Now it's time for me to tell you why it's not always true that polypeptide and protein are interchangeable terms like I've been using them. Some proteins, or let me start it over to make it less ambiguous. It's possible for a protein to be made up of just one polypeptide. It just has one string of amino acids, and that's the whole protein. In that case, which happens for several different proteins, the word protein and polypeptide are interchangeable. They refer to the same thing. But that's not always the case. So you can't, in general, say that polypeptide and protein mean the same thing. It's also possible for a protein to be more complex, by which I mean to be made up of more than one polypeptide. Now, it could be any number more than one, and those polypeptides might be identical copies of each other, or they might be different polypeptides. But the point is that there are such things as what we call multimeric proteins. Which is really a different word that means the same thing as polymer, right? Multi and poly both mean many. But polymer, which means many part, is what we use to describe a single polypeptide. It's a polymer of amino acids. The amino acids are the monomers. You string them together to form a polymer called a polypeptide. Okay? If you have more than one polypeptide, and they are then put together to form a bigger thing, then it's really a multi-polymer structure. That's what multimeric means, made up of more than one polymer. Well, there are many proteins like this. And if we're talking about a protein that is multimeric, then the words polypeptide and protein do not mean the same thing. You see, is that clear why? If you have a multimeric protein, it's made up of multiple polypeptides. So a polypeptide in that case is just part of the overall protein. They are not the same thing. The quaternary level of protein structure occurs only for multimeric proteins. This is why I earlier said that every protein has at least the first three levels. If we're talking about proteins that are made up of just one polypeptide, then those three levels are the only levels the protein has. But if we're talking about a multimeric protein made up of two or more polypeptides, then in addition to those first three levels, the protein will also have quaternary structure. And quaternary structure refers to the overall three-dimensional arrangement of however many polypeptides it's made out of, more than one. You can see that right here. Each individual polypeptide in the overall protein still has its own tertiary structure. The quaternary structure is how all of those individual constituent polypeptides are arranged. By the way, when you build a quaternary protein, you are a multimeric protein, you are not stringing together multiple polypeptides. If you did that, you would just be making one longer polypeptide, right? So in a multimeric protein, however many polypeptides there are, remain individual polypeptides, each its own ribbon with two ends. There's another ribbon in each of these other polypeptides. Okay, so they're not hooked end to end, otherwise you would just end up making one longer polypeptide. Okay, that's the protein structure. Now, in 23, let's look at things that influence the way in which polypeptides fold up into three-dimensional shape. So they're built, and we'll look at the particulars of how they're built in a different chapter, but they're built one amino acid at a time. That determines the primary sequence, the primary structure, the overall amino acid sequence. But then they fold up based on relationships between non-adjacent amino acids. Adjacent means they're right next to each other in the string. Non-adjacent means they're separated. But, just like if you make a string of beads, non-adjacent beads won't be next to each other if you have it stretched out, but if you fold it, non-adjacent beads can come into contact with each other. And based on what the R groups are of these beads, which are amino acids really, there will be either any one of these four possible interactions that can occur. So we have here, they only use three colors, but there's four different kinds of interactions here. Notice that the violet color here represents the backbone of the polypeptide. That's all the peptide bonds. That's the amino and carboxyl groups over and over. You don't see the detail there, but that's what's holding it together end to end. As I said before, none of the R groups holds it together. All the R groups are hanging off the backbone, forming the side chain. And not all of the R groups are shown here. There's an R group on each of the amino acids, but only some select few are shown here to represent the four possible ways in which they can interact with other R groups. At first, here in the upper left, in one of the cases of the blue, is a hydrogen bond forming. Well, you can have hydrogen bonding just like you have it between water molecules if you have two polar R groups in close proximity to each other. So there's a polar R group in this one, and there's one right here, and if you bend it so that they come together, then you can have hydrogen bonding forming. That's one possibility. Well, in the violet, we have, whatever this purple is, we have what are called hydrophobic interactions. And this one kind of doesn't make sense at first. First of all, what does hydrophobic tell you about the chemical nature? Right, but what's another word for hydrophobic?
Nonpolar.
Nonpolar, exactly. Well, nonpolar things, as I said, don't have partial charge, right? Like two oxygen molecules, when they come close to each other, they ignore each other, basically, because they don't have partial charges. So how do you have hydrophobic interactions, which is an attraction between nonpolar groups? Well, let me try to draw something that hopefully will explain it. These are all nonpolar. What are CH3s? Those are methyl groups, exactly. But they are hydrocarbons, right? Nothing but carbon and hydrogen, and therefore nonpolar, equal sharing. But if you have, let's just draw it as just one CH in one group, and then a CH down here in another group, that's a different part, represents this and this. This single CH bond is two electrons, right? It's a pair of electrons being shared. So those electrons are real things that are at some position at any given moment. In other words, the electrons are either around the carbon or around the hydrogen at any given moment. They're being equally shared, but they're not at two places at once. They're either at the carbon or at the hydrogen. Same for the other one in the other R group. So even though they're equally shared, if the electrons end up oscillating in unison with each other, so that the electrons in this top one would be around the carbon at the moment, and the electrons in this bottom one would be around the hydrogen at the moment, then that would make this bottom hydrogen slightly negative and this top hydrogen slightly positive. You see that? And then the next moment it would reverse. So there would always be a very, very slight, even slighter than a hydrogen bond, which is already slight, but it would still be a slight attractive force if that happened. And it does happen. Those are called hydrophobic interactions. And if you have a bunch of atoms involved in these hydrophobic interactions, then a lot of very small amounts can add up to something that's substantial. In fact, this is why geckos can walk upside down on a glass surface. It's forming hydrophobic interactions between its feet and the glass. So that's another possibility. And by the way, these interactions, if they occur, since they are more than no interaction, those are what stabilize that particular shape. All right? But if the R groups were not in that position, because the amino acid is not in that position in the string, then they wouldn't be able to come together as easily. So this is why the primary structure, the actual sequence of amino acids, determines how the thing folds up. But what stabilizes a particular shape is because of these interactions that form. Those are pretty weak ones that we went through. The yellow one is a very strong one. This is called a disulfide bridge. And this is exactly what was represented by those yellow lines in the previous slide, or the slide earlier when I said we'll talk about these yellow things later. You get disulfide bridges when you have a sulfur-containing amino acid in one position and another sulfur-containing amino acid from a different part of the string getting close to it. If we cysteine, if you look at those 20 amino acids in the table, you'll find cysteine. And cysteine has, in its R group, a sulfhydryl group. What is sulfhydryl? Right, an SH instead of an OH like a hydroxyl. So each of these originally was an SH. But when you get two of them close together, each of the SHs loses an H. And that allows the two sulfurs to be covalently bonded together. So this is not just a weak interaction. This is an actual chemical bond forming. Much, much stronger than these top two we already talked about. And so that really stabilizes the shape of the protein, locks it into place. And you have this in a lot of different kinds of proteins, including there's a lot of it in your hair, which is why if you burn hair, it smells like sulfur. Okay, so those are the strongest by far. And then you can also have ionic bonds forming. The disulfide bridge is a covalent bond, but you can also have ionic bonds form if you get two R groups that are ionized, but in opposite directions, one positive and one negative. They will form an ionic bond just like sodium and chloride do. And that also is much stronger than the top two hydrogen bonds or hydrophobic interactions. So overall, all of these various interactions favor one particular shape that sequence of amino acids will fold up into. And that's why if you make many copies of the same exact sequence, same polypeptide in other words, but many copies, they'll all fold up into the same shape because they all have this same set of interactions. Okay, 24. This slide illustrates that regardless of what the actual shape is for any given protein, proteins are lumped based on their shape into either of two categories, which you see here. Proteins are either fibrous, meaning they are long and thin, and they form fibers, like collagen, for instance. It's a strong protein made by animals, part of your skin, for instance. It acts as little ropes, resists tensile forces, stretching forces. By the way, notice that collagen is an example of a multimeric protein, because this is one collagen when it's made up of three individual polypeptides. And in this case, it's a multimeric protein made of multiple copies of the same polypeptide. So there's only one kind of polypeptide in this, but that doesn't matter. It's still multimeric because there are multiple individual polypeptides making it up. Hemoglobin, though, represents the other major category. Proteins that aren't fibrous, that aren't long and thin, but are more compact, are called globular proteins. They form a glob instead of a filament. And that's what most proteins that are not structural proteins are, actually. Hemoglobin is just one of many examples. Notice here, though, that hemoglobin is another multimeric protein, but in this case, it's made up of more than one kind of polypeptide. There are overall four polypeptides making it up, but there's two copies of one type and two copies of another type making it up. All right, well, hemoglobin is used in this next example, slide 25, that really points out something I've mentioned a few times already this term, namely that what give organism their traits directly are the proteins that they make, but what gives organisms the ability to make those proteins is their DNA. So a gene, which is a sequence of DNA, tells a cell how to build a particular polypeptide. And if you change that DNA somehow, or if it gets changed, I should say, first of all, that's called a mutation. It's just an accidental change. It can be caused by all kinds of different things, chemicals, radiation, whatever. If you have a mutation occur, though, then the DNA is no longer telling the cell the same way to make a protein. In other words, it's going to tell it to make a different protein. And that is going to, this shows you how sensitive polypeptides are, their shape of the polypeptide is, to a change in the sequence of amino acids. Okay, so here we have hemoglobin, but really, this is only one of two genes necessary for hemoglobin, because I just told you that a single hemoglobin is made up of two kinds of polypeptides. Each polypeptide requires its own gene to tell the cell how to build it. And so the other polypeptide is normal. Well, they're both normal in this left case, but we're only looking at one of the genes, and we're not even looking at the entire gene. Well, we're not even looking at a gene at all. Sorry, we're only looking at part of the polypeptide here, only the first seven amino acids. And that's why it fades off. There's many more than seven. But this is the normal sequence, valine, histidine, so on. It's the so-called wild type, which is the type you encounter in most organisms in the population, in this case humans. All right? But a mutation can occur so that instead of making this normal sequence, some people will make it almost normal, every one of the amino acids, not just these seven, but all of them, except for number six, are normal. It's just that the sixth one has been changed because the DNA has been changed. So the cell doesn't know it's different, it's just obeying the DNA. So this is an example of just one amino acid being different in the sequence. And that drastically affects the overall shape of the protein. In normal hemoglobin, the polypeptide folds up into a shape that allows it to do a good job of carrying oxygen and carbon dioxide, the major functions of hemoglobin. It carries oxygen from your lungs through the blood to the cells that need the oxygen, picks up carbon dioxide from the cells, takes it back to the lungs so that you can get rid of it. Does a good job with its normal shape. But you change just this one amino acid and it will be so misshapen that not only will it not be able to carry oxygen and carbon dioxide very well, but it causes it to interact with other hemoglobin molecules and clump together. And this misshapes the overall red blood cell or erythrocyte in your blood, which is each of which is carrying millions of hemoglobins. It's supposed to be a normal biconcave disc shape, like you see here. But the mutation that causes this results in what's called sickle cell disease because the cells get misshapen like this. And this is a bad thing for the human that has this disorder. It causes early death because this is such a big deal. But it shows you just how sensitive shape is to primary structure, the actual sequence. All right, another thing about shape is shown in slide 26. I should have mentioned, by the way, that shape is an okay word. You know what that means. But when we talk about proteins, often instead of shape, we use the word conformation. It just means the shape of a protein, though. Any given protein, as I said, or any given polypeptide, has a specific shape that gives it its particular function. But, as I a little bit talked about back when we discussed acid rain, the shape of a polypeptide can be influenced by the environment. It's primarily, the shape results primarily from that sequence, as I said, but it can be misshapen because of variables in the environment, including two biggies, which are temperature and pH. And you don't have to change the temperature or the pH very much in either direction for there to be quite a big change in shape. And if you make too drastic a change in shape, then the protein is not only going to not work as well, it's not going to work at all. And we call a drastic change in conformation or change in shape of a polypeptide or protein denaturation. Cooking is a good example of this. Right, if you cook a steak, for instance, it is drastically different in texture compared to when it was raw, right? And it's mostly protein, and that's because you're denaturing those proteins. Well, that's a permanent denaturation. In other words, if you decide after it's cooked that you don't really want the steak, you can't just let it cool down and it's not going to turn back into a raw steak. It's a permanent change in the shapes of the proteins. Well, for cooking, that's one thing, but in a living organism, if you permanently change the shape of a protein, you've eliminated the function of that protein, so it's just trash at that point. What the cell will have to do is just dismantle it into individual amino acids, which can then be put back together to build a brand new one with the right shape. But you can't undo denaturation unless it's very slight. If you change it a little bit by the environment, temperature or pH, for instance, and then you restore normal temperature or pH, it might go back into its proper shape. That's renaturation. But if you get it too hot or too cold, or if you change the pH too drastically, then it's going to be permanently eliminated from functionability, and you have to start over. Fortunately, cells can always start over because that's what the genes are, manuals for how to build another copy. Here we're looking at the fact that some proteins need the help of still other proteins in order for them to take on their proper shape. Some polypeptides, once they're built, as you know, you can think of them as just being stretched out when they're first built. Some of them will just naturally fold up into whatever shape they're supposed to assume on their own, without any help. But others can't do that in the main compartment of the cell because of the environmental factors. And so they need to be put into more or less a little canister, kept away from the rest of the cell components for the moment, so that they can assume the correct folding. And that little canister is another protein forming the canister. And we call those chaperone proteins or chaperonins because they are chaperoning the brand new polypeptide that needs the help of the chaperone in order to get its correct shape. Once that shape is attained inside the canister or the chaperone protein, then the new correctly folded protein is released and it can do its job. All right, now that is almost the end of the proteins section, except 28 here is really a transition slide that involves both proteins and the fourth and final category of biological macromolecules that we haven't yet discussed, which is nucleic acids. So this slide involves both nucleic acids and proteins. And this also reinforces what I was saying about DNA indirectly affecting traits by directly telling a cell what kind of proteins it makes, and then those proteins directly determining the traits. What we have here, first of all, is what kind of cell? It's eukaryotic because it has a true nucleus. Now, the DNA is going to be in any kind of cell, whether it's eukaryotic or not. We just happen to be looking at a eukaryotic example. But if it's a eukaryotic cell, then the DNA, is, of course, in the nucleus. And DNA is one of two major categories of nucleic acid, the fourth category of macromolecules. That's what the NA part stands for. It's deoxyribonucleic acid, which we've gone over, I think. And remember that they were named nucleic acids because that's where they were discovered first, in the nucleus of eukaryotic cells. But even prokaryotic cells have DNA, and for the same reason. The DNA is one kind of nucleic acid. It is involved in a process called transcription that we'll study in a later chapter that involves reading the code in the DNA for the purpose of assembling a different nucleic acid, RNA, specifically messenger RNA, which is shown in red here. That's what transcription does. It uses DNA information to make a messenger RNA molecule. And then the messenger RNA molecule is now holding the instructions for how to build the protein. DNA is done. Its job is done at this point. And then the messenger RNA molecule is involved in a second process after transcription is done. Transcription produces the mRNA. mRNA is then involved in a second process called translation, which is when the polypeptide actually gets assembled. So the messenger RNA code tells the cell, specifically ribosomes in the cell, which we'll look at in the next chapter. Ribosomes are little organelles, the brown things here. It tells the ribosomes how to build a specific kind of polypeptide. In other words, the messenger RNA tells the ribosome, this is how many amino acids are going to be strung together, and this is the particular one of the 20 that occurs in each position, which bead to use, in other words. And that's why it's shown as a string of beads here, in purple beads. That's the polypeptide. Once it's done, once translation is done and the polypeptide is built, then it will assume a three-dimensional shape based on that specific sequence. Okay, so that slide serves as the end of proteins and the beginning of the final section of the slideshow, which is about nucleic acids. Let's go to 29. and look at a nucleic acid. Now, when I gave you alternative names, I used three words that clearly indicate that three of the four macromolecules are polymers. What were those three names?
Polypeptide,
which refers to proteins.
Polynucleotides. Polysaccharides.
And polysaccharides. Those are polymers. What's the fourth category that's not a polymer?
Lipids.
Okay, so we've been through all of those except for polynucleotides. A nucleic acid is a polynucleotide, or it's at least one polynucleotide, I should say. Polynucleotide, though, refers to a single end-to-end arrangement of monomers, just like polypeptide does, except the monomers used are different. If you're building a polypeptide, what you're stringing together as a single end-to-end arrangement are amino acids, as we just discussed. If you're building a polynucleotide, it's still an end-to-end arrangement, and it also doesn't branch, just like a polypeptide. But the monomers you use are not amino acids. Instead, they are subunits called nucleotides. That's why it's called a polynucleotide when you hook together a bunch of them. So let's look at the middle here, which is just one isolated nucleotide. Even though a nucleotide is a single subunit, there are three components to it, to each individual nucleotide. We can see those three components right here. One of those is a sugar. The green part is the sugar. But it's not any sugar, not just any sugar. It is specifically a pentose, which we've already learned is a 5-carbon sugar, right? So pentose is not a specific chemical. It's a category of sugars. It's a pentose sugar, and specifically, a nucleotide has either of two possible pentoses. It's either deoxyribose, shown here in the bottom right, this is one pentose, or it's ribose. They're shown side by side. Okay, it's not both, it's one or the other in a nucleotide. All right, now let's compare these two. They're almost identical, deoxyribose and ribose. Look at ribose first. Now compare that to the structural formula of deoxyribose, and you'll see that the only difference is right here at the functional group connected to carbon number 2. In ribose, it's a hydroxyl, has an OH. In deoxyribose, it's just an H, which is exactly why this is called deoxyribose. It's just like ribose without one of the oxygens, deoxyribose. All right? Well, ribose is the only kind of sugar used in nucleotides that get hooked together to form RNA, ribonucleic acids. Deoxyribose is the only sugar used in all of the nucleotides that hook together to form DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid. Okay, now back to these individual three components of one nucleotide. You have the sugar, and connected to that are two different things connected at different places on the sugar. One is a phosphate group. We've already discussed phosphate groups, and this is one of the other reasons why phosphate is so indispensable to life. You can't have any DNA without it. The other thing connected to the same sugar, but at the other side of it, is some sort of nitrogenous base. So a nitrogenous base is not a specific chemical. It is a category, once again. All right? And then nitrogenous bases come in 5 main varieties under normal circumstances. in DNA or RNA, there's five possibilities overall, but there's only four possibilities for DNA, and there's only four possibilities for RNA. So there's five overall possibilities. Four of those occur in DNA, and a different four of those same five occur in RNA. If this is a DNA nucleotide, which it will be if the sugar is deoxyribose, then the four possible nitrogenous bases are adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine, A, G, C, and T abbreviations. But if this is an RNA nucleotide, which you would know because the sugar is ribose instead, then the choices for the nitrogenous base are adenine, guanine, cytosine, and uracil instead of thymine. Okay? Now let's think about why this is important. If you're building a polynucleotide, which is many nucleotides long, then it's either a DNA or an RNA. And if it's an RNA, then every one of those nucleotides will have ribose as the sugar. So within one nucleic acid, there is no variety of nucleotides with respect to sugar. The sugars will all be the same in that same nucleic acid. Same can be said for phosphate groups. They're all the same. So there are different kinds of nucleotides, but not because of the sugar or the phosphate. Just like for amino acids, there are different kinds of amino acids, but not because of the carboxyl or the hydrogen or the amino group. It's only the R group that makes them different, right? Well, here, the only variable part of a nucleotide is the nitrogenous base. And there's four choices for RNA. There's four choices for DNA. So when you build a polynucleotide, which is an end-to-end arrangement just like a polypeptide, you have four kinds of beads to work with instead of the 20 that you have to work with building polypeptides. But that is what makes DNA and RNA, nucleic acids in general, informational molecules. They convey information, they store information in the form of the particular sequence of A's, T's, C's, and G's. Or A's, C's, U's, and G's for RNA. That sequence is what gives the nucleic acid its information. It stands as a code. Just like sequences of letters mean something in language. And if you scramble those letters, you've lost the information, right? This is why a polynucleotide has to remain in a specific sequence, meaning the nucleotides need to be held together well so that you don't scramble the code. Well, to assemble that polynucleotide, you need to hook nucleotides together. And to keep it from being scrambled, you hook them together with covalent bonds, which you know is the strongest kind of bonds. That's what keeps the message from being scrambled. Now, before I get to that, let me not forget to mention that one nucleotide is made up of a nucleoside, which is simply the sugar and the nitrogenous base on its own, hooked together. In other words, if you didn't have a phosphate, this would just be a nucleoside, as you see labeled here. Be careful with that word because it only differs from nucleotide by one letter. But a nucleotide is a nucleoside with at least one phosphate group. Okay. Now, let's hook these two things together. And like I said, we want to hook them together with strong bonds, covalent bonds, so that the sequence remains the same. Think back to proteins or a polypeptide. What holds it together along its length is only the bonds, the peptide bonds, which doesn't involve the R groups at all, right? R groups are not involved in holding the polypeptide together. Similarly, the variable part of a nucleotide, which is the nitrogenous base, is not at all involved in holding together the sequence of nucleotides in a polynucleotide. Only the other two components of the nucleotide are involved, namely the phosphate and the sugar. So to hook them together, you need to make a covalent bond between the phosphate of one nucleotide and the sugar of the next nucleotide. And then its phosphate can be hooked to the sugar of the next nucleotide, and so on. That forms what's called the sugar phosphate backbone. That's what holds it together along its length. That's what maintains the integrity of the code, keeps it from being scrambled. Okay? Because it's sugar phosphate, sugar phosphate, sugar phosphate, over and over for however many nucleotides there are. And by the way, it's a lot of nucleotides. There's only four shown here. But one DNA is millions of nucleotides long. So it's a very long sequence of C's, T's, A's, and G's. But it's only the sugar and the phosphate holding it together. The C's, T's, A's, and G's are just hanging off the edge. Not holding it together, but serving as the code. That's what gives it the information. Any questions on that? All right, let's go to 30 and look at a DNA. Now this is deoxyribonucleic acid, which is what DNA stands for. So if you saw the detail, you don't see the sugars and the phosphates here, but if you saw that, every one of those sugars would be deoxyribose. One thing that, you know, there are obviously differences between RNA and DNA, and one is the sugar that's used. But another difference is that DNA usually exists as a two-stranded structure. The so-called double helix of DNA refers to the fact that it's made up of two polynucleotides. Each strand, which is half of the DNA, is itself a complete molecule, a polynucleotide. All right, in the previous slide, we saw one polynucleotide, very short one, but this is a polynucleotide by itself. DNA has two polynucleotides, similar to a multimeric protein, where you have two complete polypeptides that are then somehow associated with each other. In DNA, you have two DNA polynucleotides that are associated with each other to form what we call one DNA. But really, one DNA is two molecules held together by hydrogen bonding. The hydrogen bonding in slide 30 is represented by these ellipses. Each triple dot here represents a slight attractive force between a nitrogenous base on one strand and a nitrogenous base at the same position on the other strand. Each individual hydrogen bond is very slight, but you have millions of them in one DNA because there are so many nucleotides long, and that keeps them together well. But a little bit ago I told you that it's really important to not scramble the message, to maintain the integrity of the code, the sequence, and that's why covalent bonds are used in the sugar phosphate backbone, holding each individual strand together along its length permanently. Well, you wouldn't want there to be covalent bonds holding the two strands to each other. And that's because of what DNA's two major jobs are. Now, it's been a while since the first week. A lot of information has passed through your brain since then. But back then, I mentioned two major functions of DNA. Do you remember what those are? Remember me even talking about it.
Is it transcription replication?
Yes. Transcription, which I just mentioned a moment ago, is one of the DNA's jobs. That's when it serves as a code for how to make RNA. The other is replication, which is right before a cell splits, it has to make two copies of its DNA, or it has to copy the DNA it has, so it has two copies. That's replication. Well, either of those two major functions, transcription and replication, requires reading the code. And reading the code requires separating the two strands from each other so that you can get in there and read the nitrogenous base sequence, or the nucleotides, in nitrogenous base sequence. I was right the first time. You have to do that for both replication and for transcription. So you wouldn't want those bonds holding the two strands together to be too strong. They're hydrogen bonds, which are easily broken so that you can unzip temporarily the two strands from each other, read the code, and perform either transcription or replication, and then let them go back together. All right? That's why it's hydrogen bonding between nitrogenous bases on opposite strands. So the overall shape of DNA is like a twisted ladder or a spiral staircase. It's the so-called double helix because each individual strand forms one helix, one corkscrew shape. The other one's forming a corkscrew shape right next to it. And the pairs of nitrogenous bases, which is what base pairs comes from in the DNA language, are like one step in the spiral staircase. Each nitrogenous base is like half of a step, hydrogen bonded to the other half of the step. You can see here that DNA is being replicated in this example. The blue part is the original DNA made of two strands. You separate those two strands, you read the sequence, and then you build new strands based on that sequence for each of the two strands, and you end up with two double-stranded DNAs that are identical to each other. We'll look at the particulars of that later. Another thing I want to say about this, though, while we're still here, is that a double-stranded DNA has what is called an anti-parallel arrangement. Which, to understand that, where are the two L's? At the end, or I can't remember. Is it? It is this. Okay. To understand anti-parallel arrangement, you have to first understand that a single polynucleotide, which in a DNA would be just one of the two strands, has polarity to it. But this word polarity doesn't have anything to do with charge in this case. Polarity just means that there's a difference from one end to the other, like North and South Pole. One of the ends of a strand is called the 5' end, which if we temporarily go back to 29, we can see the 5' end. That just refers to the end that is associated with the number five carbon in the sugar. Where the O is not a carbon, but you start numbering after that. This is a carbon 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. So that's the 5' end of the overall strand. This other one is the 3' end because that's involved with position 3 on the sugar. All right. So no matter how long a polynucleotide is, one end will be the 5' end, one end will be the 3' end. And in a complete DNA, which is two strands, one of the strands, 5' end, will be matched up with the 3' end of the other strand. And just the opposite on the other end. So it's kind of a head-to-tail arrangement. That's what anti-parallel refers to. Another important, really important property of DNA is that there is complementarity, which we'll get much more deeper into in the second half of the course when we spend the whole rest of the term on DNA. Complementarity, or for them to be complementary, means that, I'm not even going to get into complementarity yet, so we have plenty of time to discuss that later. This is enough information for it just being a molecule. By the way, the slide 31, some chapters have a table like this at the end, which is a summary. I keep them in here because you might find them useful to study with, but I don't read these to you. I've covered it all, though, so it is information you have to know. All right, that's it.